Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name's Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Jeff Pitino.
How are you?
And we're the guys that work at the Binary Research Institute, where we investigate the possibility that ancient civilizations might know a little more than we currently give them credit for. And to that end, we interview a number of people that have investigated ancient civilizations from an archaeological standpoint or anthropology. Is there an area of focus or even architecture or art? And today we have a very special guest, actually two guests. That's Robert and Olivia Temple. And Jeff, can you give a little background on Robert?
I sure can. Robert is visiting professor of history and philosophy of science at Tsinghua University in Beijing. He's a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society and a member of the Egypt Exploration Society, the Royal Historical Society, the Institute of Classical Studies, and the Society for the Promotion of Hellenic Studies. He's the author of 12 books, including The Serious Mystery, Oracles of the Dead, and The Genius of China. He and his wife, Olivia, have also translated Aesop, The Complete Fables.
Which was a favorite of yours when you were a kid. Huh?
They were.
Good. Well, Robert, Olivia, you on the line there?
Yes, sure. Hello.
Hello, Olivia. Robert.
I'm here, but I'm the subsidiary personality.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. I've known of your works for years, Robert, and always admired and respected the depth of study and just good old due diligence you've put into your subjects. And I really found that was the case with your new book here, The Sphinx Mystery. And Jeff, can you hand me the book there? Thank you. It's subtitled The Forgotten Origins of the Sanctuary of Anubis. And so that's what we'll talk about today. And Robert, I guess maybe just go back to the very beginning, if you wouldn't mind, just to tell us how you became interested in Egypt in the first place.
Well, I expect just about everybody's interested in Egypt. And I became interested as a child when I used to look at things in the encyclopedia and everybody talked about it. And it's always been in the air. So I had the same ordinary interest in ancient Egypt that anybody would have. But when I became interested particularly in the Sphinx was when Olivia and I stood there and looked at it for the very first time years ago, and we both thought there was something very odd about it, extremely odd. Something was wrong, and so I've been actively researching that with Olivia's assistance for 10 years now. And it's taken that long to write this book.
Okay, well, it sure shows in the amount of scholarship that's gone into it. I'd never read so many historic accounts of the Sphinx before. So congratulations on really pulling together a lot of facts into one easy read here.
Well, we made an attempt to put in the back of our book everything that had ever been published about the Sphinx from the ancient Roman author Pliny in the first century A.D. up until and through 1837, at which point we became exhausted and stopped.
I'll just give you a little quote from Pliny, which I think you'll enjoy.
Please.
When he went and stood in front of the Sphinx, he noticed that the face of the monstrous creature is painted with ruddle, which is painted red, as a sign of reverence. Then, in 1552, another visitor to the Giza Plateau, André Thévet, said, Pliny mistakenly spoke of this sphinx or colossus, saying it was more admirable and remarkable than all the pyramids. This comparison is about as true in terms of grandeur and size as would be that of comparing a rat to an elephant. And if he had seen it and studied it as closely as I did, he would not have written such nonsense. This is the sort of thing we found.
That's very interesting. And it's neither a rat nor an elephant. And I guess if we're to understand your argument, nor is it a lion either. And some of the things that you brought out in your book that are obvious to many is that the head is too small.
Mm-hmm.
That there's water erosion on the Sphinx enclosure, especially, and of course on the body underneath many of the repairs. And there's no mention of the Sphinx in the Old Kingdom accounts. And so it seems like you dug into these sort of anomalies and tried to make sense of them.
That's right. And the secret, in a way, is to be able to go back in your mind and in your psychic abilities way, 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 way back before people have got an inkling of memory. And then you see it all in perspective. And the ancient Egyptians had a very, very keen mathematical geometric canon, the canon of proportion, and this is carried out in all the things they design and build, from tiny little statues to the pyramids, and the Sphinx just is not in proportion.
Exactly, and why would they build something out of proportion when everything else they did was in proportion?
And not only that, because it's all carved out of the limestone rock, they had plenty of rock there. Why would they actually go to the trouble of carving away a lot of it when all they had to do was leave it and it would be in proportion?
And don't forget that for thousands of years, the only part of it that showed was the head. So it wasn't obviously out of proportion until the sand was cleared many times over by various excavators and archaeologists, that it was realized that the head is not in proportion with the body.
Yes.
In fact, since Roman times, this had been unknown up until it began to be a bit obvious in 1817 when the front of it was cleared. But it wasn't until 1926 that it was almost cleared, in 1936 when it was totally cleared. As soon as you could see this gigantic body and what a tiny pimple the head is in the front, it was impossible to realize that the whole thing, well, we just had it all wrong. And that's just not the original head. It's been recarved and cut down. So the question is, who did that and why? And what was it before that happened to it? So that's a large part of the theme of the book.
Yeah, and I think it's just a beautiful story, the way you weave it in, building up to the discovery of when it was recarved, and the photos you have of the original pharaoh that it's recarved after. Can you tell that story?
Yes, the people who like to discuss the face of the Sphinx mostly agree that it's the face of a pharaoh, of course. That is the existing face that it has. Who else would it be but some pharaoh? And most people argue with one another whether they think it's Cheops or Khafre of the 4th dynasty in the Old Kingdom. But it doesn't look anything remotely like Khafre, because we have a wonderful statue of him, and he had a very long, lean face, which is rather unmistakable and bears no resemblance whatsoever to the face that's on the Sphinx. And although there's no surviving statue of Cheops apart from a 1.5-inch high ivory carving, assuming that face looks anything like him, that doesn't look like the Sphinx either. So the research that we did, which is enormous, as you know, because it's a 576-page book,
yes,
established that the recarving took place after the Old Kingdom was over. There was a period known as the First Intermediate Period, which is a rather mild way of talking about a period of total chaos and social collapse, during which government ceased to exist in Egypt and law and order came to an end, and there were known to be mobs rampaging and rioting around the Giza plateau. They smashed all the statues of Khafre that were in his temple and so on. And it must have been at that time that the original head of the Sphinx was vandalized, which would have been easy considering what we believe that it actually was. And so it wasn't until civilization was reestablished in the period known as the Middle Kingdom, about 150 years after the Old Kingdom came to an end, people pulled themselves together, that there was civilization again in Egypt. And we came up with the evidence, which I think is conclusive photographic evidence, plus a meticulous analysis of all kinds of things which are actually found in the book, which demonstrate, or I would say prove, that the fate on the Sphinx is that of the third pharaoh of the Middle Kingdom, whose name was Amenemhet II. And we have pictures of him in the book, and we have pictures of the Sphinx's face, and you can see that they're identical. And there are many other points of analysis which are based on the number of the pattern of stripes on the headdress and eye paint stripes and all kinds of details like that, which are known to be from certain periods. And you put the evidence all together, and really the conclusion is inevitable. It just draws itself to a conclusion that it was that particular pharaoh who put his face on the Sphinx.
Yes.
In 1220, an Arab visitor wrote that the face is remarkably handsome and the mouth expresses much grace and beauty. One might fancy smiling gracefully.
She's talking about me.
Don't you think it's... What I like about that is that it's got that enigmatic quality which the Sphinx does have of a sort of Mona Lisa smile. Several of the early travelers noticed that.
Yes, I would agree, and it is a handsome face, and it's amazing that this statue has been in the Louvre, and it looks identical, and yet others have not drawn the same conclusion. Why is that?
Well, this is because of consensus reality. Most people think in herds, and they all agree to see what they think they should see, or they've been told they should see. And they are very frightened of attempting to have an original idea because they think people will laugh at them or they won't be part of a group. And it takes, I suppose, a weirdo like myself, who's never been a member of any group and can't think of anything more dreadful than to be one, who is completely free of the curse of herd thinking, who's not afraid to say, the emperor has no clothes, or in this case, the Sphinx doesn't have its original head.
Well, you also don't like being told by other people what to think, even, may I say, at airports and things when we want to know what the gate is. And I say to Robert, it's gate 8. He says,
well, that's a male trait, Olivia.
How do you know it's gate 8? Wait a minute, I have to check. I've just seen it's gate 8. Well, I'm going to go and have a look. So that's what he's like about everything.
I don't believe anybody or anything.
Oh, yeah. Dear.
Well, I think... you know, the dating obviously is sort of the main constrictive point here, because most Egyptologists agree that it has to be earlier than, the beginning of the Middle Kingdom, and therefore they wouldn't even consider that face of, what did you say, Amenhet II?
Amenemhet, yeah.
Amenemhet. And therefore, they've just sort of passed it over. But by being open-minded to the possibility that it was recarved, I think...
They couldn't detach the head from the body, and that's where they went wrong. By the way, I'll just say that anyone listening who finds the name of the pharaoh confusing, in the New Kingdom, much, much later, there was a pharaoh called Amenhotep the second. Now, that's not the same as Amenemhet II. In other words, the Amenemhets were in the Middle Kingdom and the Amenhoteps were in the New Kingdom.
Good point.
One could easily confuse them, especially as, you know, we didn't know them personally, and it's easy to get people mixed up who are merely friends of friends.
And they're very difficult names.
So would you put the recarving...
They're pretty difficult people, too.
Is the recarving then 6th, 7th dynasty? What's the best date you can put?
12th. That's the 12th dynasty.
Oh, it's 12th. Okay.
Do you suppose part of the herd mentality is that Amenemhat II is not as prominent a pharaoh as some of the others. So,
therefore, why have a statue?
Why would he have a statue?
That's right.
And he only reigned for a very short time. In fact, I think it was 9 years, wasn't it?
It may have been longer than that, but the main thing about Amenemhat II, poor chap, is he's had a rather scanty press. And if you read various histories of Egypt, like if you read Petrie's, for instance, or some of the others, you won't find much about him, and he's not really mentioned by Hunum or anyone particularly. The only person who ever made much fuss about him in the sort of standard histories of Egypt was Budge. We'd like to call Budgie.
Wallace Budge.
That's
yes.
Right.
Yes.
We call him Budgie because that was his nickname and because he worked most of his life just down the road from us. So we feel that we should have the right to call him Budgie.
You should have that right.
And shall I call you Walt?
Please.
Next thing, Robert will be calling the Sphinx Sphinxy.
Well, I was just going to say, clearly Amenemhat didn't have the best PR firm working for him. He should have changed
his name.
Yeah, or maybe he should have hired some more publicists to get his name out there. Yeah.
He's got to change his agent at least.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Another fascinating thing that one finds from reading the early travelers' tales is that it's repeatedly suggested that the Sphinx gave oracular responses. In other words, it was likely that inside it contained empty parts into which priests would go in order to be able to reply on its behalf to questions which were being posed to it. So it was thought of as an oracle center.
Yes, which was a common occurrence in that day and age, of course. And I understand you've found a lot of evidence to indicate that people knew of some chambers within the Sphinx.
Yes.
And even though nowadays people, really question that fact. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I've actually crawled around inside the Sphinx, which I suppose not many people have done. And the one thing under the Sphinx that everybody knows about, although few have seen it, is what I call the rump tunnel, which might be a bit of a rude way to talk about it, but it's beneath the Sphinx's bottom. And I've been down there, and it's just a little sort of place to crouch carved out of the bedrock, I believe it's at a late stage, and probably used for sacred dreams. People would sleep overnight and have a dream if they were ill, and that kind of thing. But there's another tunnel that goes up from there, and if you could crawl along it, it would go forward. It goes as far as the Sphinx's waist, but it's very perilous, and it's supported inside with wooden struts. And when I tried to crawl along it, the struts moved, and I was worried that the thing was going to collapse on me. So I didn't dare go to the end of that, which is one of my few occasions when I actually turned back because it looked really pretty dodgy. So I didn't do it. But I did take photos inside the Sphinx, which I've published in the book, looking down and looking up. And I have discovered that tunnel was sealed off at the far end in 1926 by a Frenchman called Emile Barrès. And that it originally went to what was an intruded shaft, which was in the haunches of the Sphinx. And I found, by extremely difficult research in libraries, 281 years of printed eyewitness accounts by people who actually entered a chamber beneath the Sphinx, which was not the same as the one that I call the rump tunnel, but was actually beneath the Sphinx's waist. And it's described, its position is precisely described. We know how many feet it was from the head and how many from the back. We know the exact size of the shaft, length and width, and we know precisely where it was and that it led down to chambers. There was a chamber there that contained the remains of a coffin with resin impregnated wood and had clearly been a burial chamber. But because there were hieroglyphics carved on the walls, which are described by one or two of the people who entered the chamber, I seriously doubt that it was original. And so consequently, I believe that the shaft and the burial and the chamber underneath the Sphinx were what are known as intruded, an intruded shaft and an intruded burial, which means it was done later on.
Okay, well, hold that thought, Robert. We need to take a quick break. We'll talk more about the shafts and what the Sphinx was when we return. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back.
Intruded burial chamber, or intruded burial inside the chamber underneath the Sphinx.
Yes. So I found these reports by early travelers, and that's one of the reasons why Olivia and I decided that we must include all these reports in the back of the book, and we translated all these damn things. Olivia translated a huge amount of things from French, very early French, which was not easy, and I translated the German, and we had one in Dutch that we got a friend to translate. And there's this huge collection of what everybody had to say about the Sphinx for hundreds of years. Well, in fact, for 2,000 years. And so in those reports are all these accounts. So there's a chapter in the book which summarizes them all. And for a period of 281 years, published eyewitness reports kept being published about this chamber beneath the Sphinx. And it really is incredible that no living Egyptologist is aware of it.
That is amazing.
It's astounding. You see, the problem with the Egyptologists is that they have no scholarly abilities, that they can read their hieroglyphics and they can dig, but they don't know how to do research in libraries. They can do research when they've got a spade in their hand, if that's a search, but they're not very good at collating their results with what other people have done. So consequently, you get a lot of excavations which have taken place maybe 50 years ago somewhere, and those reports are published somewhere, but nobody can be bothered to look them up necessarily. And so the way these people work is they do their digs and they get their findings and they publish them, often with immense delays of 15, 20, 25 years. That's not by any means unusual that you get those delays. And sometimes they never publish because they die first, as happened with poor Michael Hoffman, for instance. In fact, sometimes it goes down the generations. Olivia and I went to Higher Accomplice and we met Barbara Adams, who was a charming woman. And she's gone and died prematurely of cancer. And she told us when we were there, oh, God, my mentor, Michael Hoffman, died early, and he left all his notes, and I've got to somehow find the time to publish Michael's excavation reports, plus my own. Well, then she went and died early, and so she not only didn't finish publishing her own notes, but she didn't finish publishing the notes of her predecessor, and so this is the kind of catastrophic communication lapses that can occur when you've only got a handful of people doing important work, and also when they're out there in the sun with heat stroke, they can't be in a library doing research. You're either a field person or you're not. And when we went and met Gunter Dreyer, the head of the German Institute in Cairo, down at Abydos when he was excavating the tomb of the last king of the Second Dynasty, Khasekhemwy, which we photographed and he showed us, I said to him, gosh, here you are at Abydos, and you're only 2 hours' drive from Dendera. How wonderful. And you've been here for 20 years. I suppose you go down to Dendera whenever you have a chance to look at that wonderful temple. And he said, well, I've been there twice.
That's it.
Twice in 20 years to Dendera, can you believe? Even a tourist does better than that. And so later I said to another Egyptologist who was the head of an institute, but I won't say who he was, Dreyer told me he's only been to the Temple of Dendera twice in 20 years. He's just two hours down the road. What do you make of that? And he said, well, you've got to understand about Gunter. He just does graves. He doesn't do temples.
Oh, boy.
I just want to read you another tiny little quote from another traveler.
Please.
To stress how it was really common knowledge that there were chambers inside the Sphinx, this chap, who's from 1565, German fellow, says that the Sphinx is an immensely large creature. It has on its right side, in its flank, a quadrangular hole through which, as we were informed, in olden days, one could go inside and could ascend into the head. Inside there, the priests spoke, which the Egyptians took for oracles. This comes up again and again, that there were gaps and small chambers and tunnels inside the Sphinx.
Well, given the fact that you've written such
there's a chamber between in the bedrock beneath the surface between the paws of the Sphinx, which just has a grill over it, and I published a photo of that in the book. And as early as 1817, when it was excavated and cleared by Caviglione, the Italian excavator, the British consul Henry Salt blocked up the tunnel that led from there. And nobody's ever bothered to unblock it. And people have been blocking up tunnels and blocking up entrances to chambers in the Sphinx ever since 1817. And I've got a photo in the book of Olivia leaning against a blocked-up entrance to the north side of the Sphinx that was last opened in 1926. I tried to go and find the photos of the opening. And there was a photo of a man standing inside the Sphinx, which is actually in an archive in Paris. And the Egyptologist who was in charge of the archive refused to let me see it because she said that we didn't think the same way about the Sphinx. So that's all described in the book.
Boy.
There's one very funny little account by a fellow who, I'm not sure where he comes from. I think he might have been Dutch. He says, about 400 steps from here, we saw a great colossus called Sphinx. The ancient Egyptians called it the epitome of marvels. It was their principal idol, that which rendered their oracles by means of the devil. It is, its form is half woman and half bull. Another chap says that it is a marvelous thing. I did not measure the figure, but I quickly left that place for fear of Arab seeds. You get all these wonderful stories that make you really feel you're there. And we mustn't forget either that Cairo was actually a long haul from the Sphinx and the pyramids. It wasn't just the easy little bus ride it is now. It would have taken a couple of hours on horseback.
You also had to have soldiers with you to protect you from bandits. And when Olivia and I have been doing archaeological work in Egypt, not at Giza, but elsewhere, we've had soldiers with us. We've had as many as 30 men stand around us in a circle with their machine guns pointing outwards in case terrorists tried to attack us while we were examining a site.
Well, now that you've written this book and we have this information in one place, hopefully others don't have to go through those circumstances. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back listening to Cosmic Influence. One.
And welcome back to Cosmic Influence. So, Robert, what was the Sphinx originally?
We believe that it was a crouching statue of the dog Anubis, who was the god or canine god who was the guardian of the necropolis, of the cemetery. And if you look at the position of the Sphinx, it's exactly like that of a crouching dog with its legs stretched out in front. And it has a completely flat back. Does not have a rising chest and mane, does not have anything remotely like the body of a lion. And we believe that it was simply Anubis guarding the entrance to the realm of the dead.
If you look at a picture of a greyhound or a hunting dog sitting, waiting for instruction, it looks just like Anubis. There are actually some dogs that still survive that look very similar. There's a breed called the Ibethan hunting dog in Ibiza, and the Pharaoh hound, which actually they've discovered isn't directly related to the Egyptian hound, but it looks almost identical to Anubis with the erect ears and the very long body and the long, long legs.
Yeah, on the cover of our book, there's a drawing which we commissioned of a crouching Anubis, and superimposed on it is the Sphinx as it is today. And you can see that the recarved head fits perfectly within the neck of what would originally have been the head of Anubis. And during the time of turmoil, which I mentioned earlier, when there were riots at Giza at the collapse of the Old Kingdom, it would have been very easy to knock the pointy ears and the sharp nose off the face and give the Sphinx basically a stump of a head.
Waiting for somebody else to put their face on it, which, of course, a pharaoh would do, because he would be chuffed at the idea of having a permanent record of his grandeur and his fame and his reign.
Yes,
and
all.
Been a shy person.
I was going to say, a pharaoh with an ego? I've never heard of such a thing.
And all the photos you have of other lions and lion statuettes clearly show the back of the neck sloping because of the mane.
Yes.
Whereas the back of the neck on the Sphinx we see today, of course, does not slope.
We've got the book is full of pictures of lions as traditionally drawn in Egypt from the first dynasty onwards, and of dogs in order to show the difference. And it's clear proof that the Sphinx does not have the body of a lion and never did.
But the lion used to represent power, didn't it? So it was meant to be a lion in many cases, and it would have been forgotten that the Sphinx had once been this Anubis creature, and so it would be understandable that they would think of it as a lion, and it would become a lion in the mind's eye.
Well, this story of it being a lion began in Egypt itself during the New Kingdom, when the Sphinx was excavated by a pharaoh called Thutmose IV, who erected a great big stone in the front called the Dream Stela,
yes,
recording his sacred dream, in which he was told that if he would excavate the Sphinx, he would become king because he was the younger son. And he did. And so
that famous story that was passed down.
He wanted it to be a lion because the lion was the royal animal, the king's animal, and it suited him. He didn't know whose face was on it, of course, because he didn't remember who Amenemhat II was, and he certainly had no idea that the statue had once been Anubis, because there had been too many discontinuities in Egyptian history for anyone to remember. So he decided, this suits me very well. It's got a nice pharaoh face on it, and I'll say it's a lion because that fits my story. And I'm going to put my stone up in front and call it mine and make a little altar here, and people could come and worship it, and they can think about me at the same time. That's good or great for my image. So he did have a good PR agent.
If you go back, if you look through something called the coffin texts, which were from the Middle Kingdom, which were never meant to be seen by the living, they were specifically found in coffins of the period, and they were in the form of protective spells, which would be helping you to get beyond the netherworld to the next life. In some of these coffin texts, we are told that the deceased has entered into the gate, which is Netherworld, into its gate, which is under the care of Anubis. His name is Dogface. His shape is big.
Yes, I thought that part of your research was excellent, where you show references to Anubis, but there's the historical record is absent references to a large lion figure there in the Old Kingdom. Is that correct?
Yes. Both the pyramid texts of the Old Kingdom and the coffin texts of the Middle Kingdom are full of descriptions of a gigantic Anubis at Giza, at the entrance to Giza, as the guardian, and it's even twice specifically described as being beside a causeway.
Mm. Okay. Which is near the end of the causeway
and
for the pyramid
text. One of the utterances, as they call them, is my entrails have been washed by Anubis. This refers to the ritual bathing of the deceased king's heart and other internal organs, which were placed in jars. But Anubis is mentioned a lot in these texts.
Well, we should explain that we believe that Anubis was surrounded by a moat.
Yes.
And that it was known in the ancient texts as Jackal Lake. It's mentioned often in the pyramid texts. And we believe that sacred ceremonies took place there. And the Sphinx pit, as it now is, has solid rock on three sides, and the front is the wall of the Sphinx temple. And I've found and photographed evidence in the single corridor between the two temples which led into this moat of traces of sluice gates and bolt holes and so on, all of which has now been covered over by so-called restoration. But I photographed it all before that happened to prove that this channel was being used to bring the inundation waters of the Nile into this moat, and then it was shut in by a sluice gate. And there was a huge channel that ran down the whole of the Giza Plateau and emptied itself into this moat to get any rainwater that might fall also to come down and get in there.
I thought your research here is really compelling, and I'd like to get into it. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back and get into that. Robert, you make the point that the temple doesn't have any openings to the Sphinx, and yet you would expect this huge temple right below it to at least have a view of it or something. And so the only opening you found was the sluice gate. Is that correct?
Yes. If there's a temple in front of the Sphinx, practically jammed up against its nose, with no door to allow you to even go and look at the Sphinx, and if you can't see the Sphinx from the temple very easily at all, and you can't get to it and you can't see it, what's going on? And also, why is the Sphinx down in this deep hole in the ground? Because it's still today the largest stone statue in the world. Why hide it? Why not flaunt it? And as they said in Gene Wilder's film, The Producers, flaunt it, baby, flaunt it. But the fact is that they're hiding the world's largest stone statue. Why are they doing that? Well, there's a very obvious reason. It was sitting in a moat, and the moat was filled with water, and they carried out these funeral ceremonies there. And the stone steps, which led down into the moat, I photographed, and there are still traces of them there. So there were little boats that the pharaoh would get into, a little boat, and he'd go around several times, around the Sphinx Island in this moat. And the reason why the water erosion marks on the Sphinx body are horizontal is that it was sitting in a moat, getting soaked at different levels over the centuries. But the reason why the water marks on the sides are vertical is because of the wind-blown sand problem, that it was blowing sand all the time into the moat, and they had to dredge it constantly. And when you were dredging the water, dredging the sand out of the moat, the water would all pour down the sides back into the moat again and scour the sides. And then the weak portions of the limestone would make these crevices, which are very, very deep, clearly caused by running water. And in the past, people have tried to explain this by saying it's the result of ancient rain.
Yes.
And they go back to 10,000 B.C. when Shock there might have been some rain. But there's no need for rain. All you needed was somebody needing to dredge the moat, and you'd get all the vertical erosion that you needed or could ever desire.
And so what do you use as a date, then, for Anubis?
Well, there's no doubt that the Sphinx was at least there in the time of Cheops, and I don't think anybody would doubt that. My particular view, and the book doesn't attempt to prove this because, in fact, I'm carrying this research forward in my next book, which is not about the Sphinx but does concern Giza a great deal, and that is that the Sphinx is probably several centuries earlier than the 4th dynasty. And in my next book, I reveal, for instance, that the temple next door, which they call the Valley Temple, actually contained some remains of a second dynasty king. That's not generally known, and in fact, I've translated the only excavation report in existence of that temple from German, and this is all in the book to come. But I've done work in these temples with permission from what they grandly call the Supreme Council of Antiquities of Egypt. I've done some dating work. I'm not an archaeologist, but I've worked in archaeometrical projects of dating the Sphinx Temple and the Valley Temple, which gave me the special access that enabled me to make many fundamental discoveries relating to the Sphinx, which I could not otherwise have done, and take photographs of the Sphinx from positions which had never been done before, so that I have unique photos of the Sphinx from angles which in the whole of history have never been taken. And I made a very fundamental discovery from the floor of the Sphinx Temple. Well, several discoveries. So it's all in the book in immense length, but the final two chapters of the book are, after we've talked about all the things which we've just discussed, to do with the deeper significance and the mythological and religious and sacred aspects of what was really going on in the resurrection cult of Giza. And I prove that the three main pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx were part of a unified design concept, and that they were all designed at once, which, of course, goes against the idea that the three pyramids were built by the successive whims of three different kings who thought they might like to have a nice place to be buried. And the fact is that these four monuments were all designed at the same time and are part of the same concept, and I've been able to demonstrate this conclusively in the book, in the final chapters, which gets a little bit more heavy going, but it's the most fascinating part of the book from my point of view, because it goes into the really, really, really weird aspects of Egyptian tradition. So weird that they're almost incomprehensible to us, and it all has to do with life and death and what happens when you die. And
totally fascinating.
Yes.
It's sort of comforting in a strange way, because the whole point of life to those people was the preparation for death, which led to the real life, which was the resurrection, in a way. And you can see the similarities with Christianity. And it's very, very fascinating and beautiful.
I publish in the book a very strange picture. The earliest surviving representation of the crucifixion of Jesus shows him on a cross with the head of Anubis.
Oh, really?
And that is a pretty weird fact. And what was really going on is that Christianity is a much more profound religion than a lot of people realize, and it's been greatly distorted by people for their own ends. But if you look into what Jesus really intended and was trying to convey, a tremendous lot of it was drawn from these extremely profound Egyptian tradition,
including the Trinity.
Yes. The Egyptians, you see, superficially appear to be polytheists, but in fact they weren't really. What they really were...
Much like the Vedic culture, by the way, which is thought to be polytheist, but not so.
That's right, because the ancient Hindus worshipped essentially Brahma, the spirit of the universe.
Different aspects of God, and unfortunately, we're getting near the end of the show here. And so, Robert and Olivia, I want to get into this more. Maybe we can do another show on it, but let me remind our listeners in the meantime that the book we're talking about here is The Sphinx Mystery, The Forgotten Origins of the Sanctuary of Anubis, and it's by Robert and Olivia Temple, and you can get it at Amazon or any one of the major bookstores, I'm sure. Well, it's been great having you on the show, Robert and Olivia, and again, I hope we can continue this conversation, because it is a fascinating subject.
It really is, and thank you so much for being on the show again.
Listening to
Yes, we have a website for the book, too.
Okay, we'll give that in the wrap-up here. One second, please. That was too fast.
That was a just fascinating show. So I hope all of you listening enjoyed it as much as we did in the conversation. I definitely hope we can have them back.
We should have recorded all the stuff on the break, too. I mean,
yeah,
they're full of information. But the website is sphinxmystery.info. So please check that out. And also, don't forget our conference this fall, the Conference on Procession and Ancient Knowledge, where we'll be talking about this topic and many related topics.
And the conference website is cpaconline.com. That's cpaconline.com.
In the meantime,
bring on the higher ages.